Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
That's right. It's time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we have a very special guest. I am delighted to introduce Twilight Greenaway, who is the managing editor of Civil Eats, one of my very, very favorite publications. Her articles about food and farming have appeared in the New York Times, on NPR.org, The Guardian, Take Part, Modern Farmer, Gastronomica, and on Grist, where she served as the food editor from 2011 to 2012. You can also read more of Twilight's work and learn more about her at twilightgreenaway.com and at twilight@civileats.com. Twilight, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to have you on. I consider you a true thought leader in the progressive food movement. So I'm really happy that you were able to join me today.
Thank you for having me, Katie. I am really happy to be here as well. And happy Martin Luther King Day.
Oh, thank you. Same to you, my darling. How come your kid had to go to school today? Isn't it, or is he too little to have?
He goes to a
preschool.
Daycare school. He's little still.
Very little. Aw, that's so nice. Well, as I told you in the earlier exchange, I dropped my daughter off at college yesterday. she is a sophomore, but
a big day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was after Christmas break, and quite honestly, Twilight, a month of Christmas break with a 20-year-old person in a small New York apartment. It's really kind of enough.
You're not the only one I've heard express that sentiment. Yeah, I'm sure it's exhausting.
Love having them home, love seeing them leave. But anyway, first of all, I want you to talk a little bit about Civil Eats in case I have listeners who are not familiar with the publication. Tell us a bit about it, because I consider Civil Eats, as part of the sort of the thought leadership on progressive food. You guys publish articles that nobody else does. So tell us a little bit about sort of the editorial agenda for Civil Eats and what you guys are hoping to accomplish with it.
Sure. So Civil Eats has been around since 2009. It was founded by Naomi Starkman and Paula Crossfield, and it came out of the Slow Food Nation event that happened here in San Francisco at that time, which was a big gathering of folks from all around the food world, talking about the way food is made and some policy issues and farming and really quite a range of topics. And the blog for Slow Food Nation was very popular, and so Naomi and Paula, who'd been both involved in the blog, decided to spin it off and make it into its own site. And I've been working on it for the last 2 years. And we are a daily online site. We do both our own original reporting. We do some news and some feature reporting. We report on the good news, the projects we think are really inspiring and are kind of moving the needle in terms of getting people to think critically about the food system and to make changes in the food system. And then we also publish some commentary, and we try to look at the kind of the story behind the story in many cases, because we're not always out there breaking news. We do that on occasion, but since we are often a little behind the curve in terms of timing, we tend to go a little deeper and really look at why things are occurring and what are the various factors behind, various policy shifts and various corporate changes that occur. So, yeah, we're really trying to bring people who have some curiosity about food in a little deeper into where it comes from and who's making it and what are the complexities in the food system.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it enormously. I've been a supporter practically since the get-go. And I definitely pony up my money for a subscription, by the way, people. Just in case listeners
Thank
out there,
you.
You can pay, you can buy this It's very, very reasonable. I think it's $25 for a year's subscription. Am I right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is so worth it.
We just added the subscription feature a year ago, and it's been great. It's really made a dent in our funding.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So we really appreciate that.
And it is so, so worthwhile. Even if you don't read it every day, you guys do a weekly roundup of food stories that I find invaluable. I mean, you know, enough. I mean, I don't mean to be like, you know, promote, but I mean, promote, because I mean, how many publications like yours exist? So let me ask you this, my darling. In the past year, we've seen a lot of big stories emerge in the progressive, you know, what I call the progressive food movement. What do you think were the biggest stories that came out? Was it, you know, the fact that labor is finally, you know, farm workers and restaurant workers are finally getting some attention, for example? Or was it more about environmental issues associated with our agricultural policies? Where did you see the big stories that were even like penetrating beyond Civil Eats and Grist and into mainstream?
Absolutely. I'd say there are quite a few, so I'll just list a couple, but this is by no means an exhaustive list. I think the growing awareness around pesticides and the some of the large international decisions that were made to classify some pesticides, particularly Roundup and 2,4-D, as carcinogenic and possibly carcinogenic. I don't know if you heard about that,
but
the WHO's International Agency Research on Cancer declared Roundup as probably carcinogenic and 2,4-D as possibly. And that was big news, really, all around the media. It was reported far and wide, and, you know, it was disputed and discussed quite a bit. But it was definitely, I'd say it was likely a factor in the fact that the EPA withdrew its approval of the new herbicide Enlist Duo, which combines glyphosate and 2,4-D.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was pretty big news. And then here in California in December, that was followed by an interesting sort of move by the state to look at atrazine, which is another very popular pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
I should be clear that these are all the most popular pesticides. These are the particularly Roundup and atrazine, very popular.
Yeah.
So they're showing up on farm fields all over the country and really all over the world. So the fact that the WHO weighed in and really was discussing this issue at this top level was a big deal. I think that was one of the big news stories of the year.
I would agree,
And I think it will continue to be discussed. So that was big. I also think some of the... Yes?
I'm sorry, I was just going to... Just to stay on that topic for one second. There been, like, in the world... When the World Health Organization came out with those statements of possibly and probably carcinogenic with relation to those two popular pesticides, were there studies of cancer populations that were primarily field workers or food workers that propelled them to make those statements? Or were these independent scientific peer-reviewed studies on just sort of the molecular makeup of these pesticides that could conceivably cause cancer in laboratory animals and there was no sort of extrapolation to human populations? Where did that end up? Do you know?
They are looking at... As far as I know, they're looking primarily at rats and at the impact on rats. But they looked. The WHO looked at a lot of different studies. They didn't just look at, you know, one or five. They looked at really the existing scientific literature and felt that they could make the probable statement about Roundup. I mean, a number of folks have argued that just about everything causes cancer these days, and that's worth discussing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that are cancerous, but I don't know that makes it less important.
Oh no, I don't think so at all. Anyway, keep going. You had another one on your list there.
Well,
sorry,
I
interrupted.
Say, no, there isn't a lot of science on humans, as you know, because it's not something that anyone would want to willingly. It's not a
right,
type
but
of research
they haven't observed.
Conduct.
They haven't observed cancer clusters.
You're right. There is some science about farm workers, and we did actually we ran a piece recently, a few months back, about how complex that can be, in particular with children.
Sure.
Looking at exposure to pesticides on food versus exposure in the air, and if you're living nearby. So I think I do think that is an issue that's popping up for people. That's becoming more important. The fact that pesticide isn't just about what's on the consumer's food, but that it does have a much much more sort of wide-reaching impact on communities and on people who work on in farm fields.
Right, right. So, and what else did you see as a big story? I mean, to me, the minimum wage story was a big story for restaurant workers, for fast food workers. Would you say that was one of your top 10, or is there something else that you
absolutely
think trumps that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the restaurant labor piece is very complicated. But I do think the fact that the workers have been so vocal for the last several years is definitely a top story. I think in restaurants, it's been really interesting to see so many restaurant owners shift away from tipping. Here in California, particularly in the Bay Area, we've had a number of folks, I worked on a piece about this summer, a number of folks moving to a no-tipping policy as a way to move the money around in a sort of a more equal way among employees, so that it's not as simple as front of the house workers, who are often the white folks, to be honest. Not as simple as them making the bulk of the money and the back of the house making almost nothing. So that, I think, is another big shift that the progressive restaurant industry is starting to embrace.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We see that here on the East Coast as well. A lot of the big restaurateurs are moving away from a tipping prop toward a
tip. Danny Myers.
Yeah, exactly.
Really high profile people.
Yeah. But I mean, in a way, those are not the restaurant workers who, you know, I mean, I don't know what he's paying his cooks, but, you know, front of the house generally, because the size of the check is so big, they're probably doing okay. But where I think about, you know, where a no tipping policy really needs to be implemented is in the fast casual category, like Applebee's or Olive Garden, or, you know, some of those big like Darden chains, and, you know, that do pay minimum wage, and where the checks are small and people are just not making enough money, period. But anyway,
sure, yes. I mean, yes.
And I'd like to see more of that.
If those restaurants were in states where the minimum wage caught up and where the tipped minimum wage caught up to a living wage, I think that would be possible. I think it's tricky because we still have a tipped minimum wage of, what is it, the federal one is still 210. I mean, there are a number of states that pay more for tipped workers, but that's just very low, as we know. So they're still relying on tips in most of those establishments.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else did you see as a big story? What about in, like, just agricultural policy, like USDA? Anything come out of the USDA that tickled your fancy?
One thing I was going to say is I do think that the fact that so many large companies are moving, are changing their practices, and it can be really tricky to tell, you know, what kind of impact they will have. But I do think that the cage-free story this year has been big. There's a lot of really large food producers moving to cage-free eggs. That's really something that's gotten a lot of mainstream coverage, and we're really going to see over the next 5 years the impacts of that. Similarly, the fact that Campbell's just moved to, granted this happened in the beginning of 2016, but Campbell's just moved to label genetically engineered ingredients, and that a number of big companies are just rejiggering their ingredients, period, I think is a really big ongoing story. In terms of the policy world, I mean, I honestly think that the FDA has done more this in the last year, or not done things that are newsworthy, more so than the USDA. The USDA often, I would say, I feel like there's a real kind of nose to the grindstone. You know, folks at the USDA are getting things done, but it's often much less visible. I mean, the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food effort is still around, and they're making change on this kind of small, consistent level that I'm often really appreciative of. But yeah, I didn't see really large headlines about the USDA this year. Did you? Am I missing something?
No. I mean, they pay a lot of lip service to how much money they've pumped into farmers markets, and that's true. But I think that's also a reflection of consumer values turning away from conventionally produced food and into you know, into food that they feel is literally safer for them, for some of the reasons we've just discussed. So I don't know whether to credit the USDA with that or whether to say, well, they're just following the lead. I don't know. The other places that I feel that I do feel you're right about the FDA, being sort of more the one that, have they done anything?
They're really at the center of the action right now.
Yeah, it is. In a lot of ways. And yet at the same time, like they haven't really, a few years ago, 3 years ago now, when they passed the those guidelines about antibiotic use. Mm-hmm. There was no teeth in that act. There was it wasn't an act. It was just guidelines. And indeed, we have seen the increase of use of antibiotics in the food chain by about 25%. And so I don't know whether you can account for that as just we have larger herds. I don't know if that's true or whether the animals are being raised to bigger sizes and they require more antibiotics. That I don't really know, although I should since I'm writing a book about that stuff. whatever it is, the FDA has completely and abjectly failed to curb the use of antibiotics in our food chain. The other countries around the world who also produce meat are watching very closely to see what happens. And, European Union, we can count on, but the rest of the world, not at all.
I was going to bring up antibiotics, too. I do think it is a big ongoing story, although there weren't... I mean, I think that this year the big story was the fact that the Obama administration kind of got involved and put out their plan, but they also, as you know, they didn't really address farming in the way that they could have or... someone should have.
And I mean, we finally just got funding for the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was signed into law in 2011. And, you haven't really seen a lot of that unroll yet either. I don't know. It's very discouraging that they pay lip service to these trends or whatever you want to call them, these movements. And then, the progress is glacial at best. So I don't know. I think that a lot more activism is required on the part of consumers using their dollars to vote for what they want in their food supply. What about trends in how people think about food? Like when you react with your readers or get letters to the editor or, comments on your stories, how do you feel consumers are reacting to these stories about food and how much do you think they're changing their buying habits as a result?
Well, I think that there really is this increasing interest, continues to increase, in the way that food is made and where it comes from and how it's made. But I also think that there, as much as people want transparency and labeling, I think that a lot of consumers are really conflicted because we know that our wages are stagnating, right? Mm-hmm. So as much as I think people would like, and a growing number of people would like to be able to vote with their dollars are limited. So I think that puts a lot of consumers in a real bind, and we hear that from quite a few people that... the access issue is really big, that that affording enough fruits and vegetables, let alone trying to source them from local farms, it's challenging on a day-to-day basis, I believe, for a lot of Americans. And I think there's also a little bit of, because we have these very large companies producing the bulk of our food, and then we have a small number of small companies and small farms, and I personally feel like they're doing really great work, but for the most part, they have to charge often twice as much, as the big companies. And I think that consumers are baffled by that difference, and most of them don't fully understand the externalized cost piece. And so I think there's a little bit of a backlash going on right now as well about artisanal food and local food and some of the fetishization that goes on with those pieces as well.
I couldn't agree with you more, and especially the use of the word fetishization, because, I mean, honestly... Well, anyway, I'm editorializing as usual. I'm not supposed to do
your
that,
show.
But
go for it.
Yeah, exactly. But I do personally find, sort of the tweeness of it all, something that has turned me off literally from the get-go. And I've always been of the opinion that if you don't, push this into the mainstream and onto, mainstream production, you're really just going to end up with a separate food system, which I think is what we have now. I think we have a food system that works for people with more money, And more education. Uh-huh. And then we have the food system for the rest of us. And that's, right. that's where I see the great failure of the progressive food movement is to have divided, into sort of silos so that, you know, to sort of avoid engaging with the mainstream people. And, unpleasant as they may be, or as scary as they may be, or as clueless as most of them are, quite frankly, you know, it's, the process of engagement is the only way that this will move forward on a mainstream level, in my opinion. I've always been, you know, quite anxious to let, say, the meat industry come on my show and talk about what they do well, because they do a lot of things well, even though most of us kind of hate what they do. But we have really cheap meat, you know, and it's like a lot of people really appreciate that, especially, you know, I did a little cost analysis, Twilight. I'm sorry, I'm taking over this show here, but I wanted to say to you, and I thought this would be a statistic everyone would enjoy, but ounce for ounce, a pack of Doritos is more costly than a pound of ground meat or pork.
That's
ground beef or pork.
But it doesn't surprise me.
Right? It's 40 cents an ounce for Doritos. And it is less than 40 cents an ounce for a pound of ground meat. Pretty interesting statistic. I don't know. And they get all those subsidies. Anyway, to move on, my dear, to move on. I'm sorry. I'm like, you know, taking over. I wanted to get, you know, people talk about food policy all the time. What does food policy mean? Tell us what that is. You know, let's get a, you know what I mean? It's like, it's something that gets thrown out there all the time. It's like, what the hell are we talking about?
I really have sort of two ways of thinking about that term. And one is the really literal form of food policy, which is that there are quite a few lawmakers proposing policy all around the country that, policies that can change farming and change, the way people consume food and change the way people buy food. I mean, a few examples. We reported last week on a soda labeling bill that has been, it's been proposed and then killed and proposed and then killed here in California, and there was some momentum building around the bill again this year, and it just got killed, or, well, it more or less died before making it out into the world, because there were a certain number of lawmakers who were abstaining from voting on it. So that's an interesting example of like a very specific, it's state level, but proponents argued that it could have had a pretty serious impact on soda consumption. And there were a few studies that came out just this month about the number of consumers who said that they would think seriously and in many cases wouldn't buy soda for their children if they saw warning labels on the bottles. So there is some hard science to support this policy as a, you know, as a good idea for public health, but the soda lobby gave quite a lot of money to lawmakers, and, or I should say the soda industry, because they don't see themselves as a lot lobby, but many people do.
Well, it's the American Beverage Association.
That's just one sort of recent example of like some actual concrete policies and how it was impacted. I think there are also some positive policies that pop up here and there. Here in California, we our cap and trade law has been in effect for a little while now, and there's some big decision making about where that money will go, and it's looking like Jerry Brown wants to put some of that back into climate-friendly agriculture. What that will really look like, I'm not sure yet. We're working on a piece about it right now, but it's promising, right? And that is happening at the policy level. If that money goes back in, if that money is going to be the product of taxes levied on larger corporations that are emitting a lot of greenhouse gases, and it goes back into farmers' budgets, and they can sort of build their soil better, or they can work to build carbon sinks on their farm in various ways. I think that's a really good example of some positive farm policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I interviewed.
But I also think that the word food policy, or the term food policy, gets tossed around to mean, or is used often to mean, food issues, food news, food, the way that people talk about food that's not just culinary, right? So I will often say that I'm a food policy writer, and that doesn't mean that everything I cover is policy exactly. I may cover what corporations are doing. I may cover what scientists are talking about. I may look at something like the WHO, and that's not exactly policy as so much as it is science and recommendations, and so mm-hmm. that, you know, it's, but it is often shorthand for the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that people have a lot of questions around that. Like, you know, they don't understand whether, you know, agricultural subsidies, is that food policy? Is it, you know, is that food policy? Do people see agricultural subsidies as part of food policy? I don't know. You know, I mean, I just think there's a lot of sort of confusion around what is sort of what we can do, what kinds of changes can be affected at a legislative level versus what kinds of changes can be affected at a consumer or societal level. And that's where I think there's sort of the disconnect around what food policy means and why
and
I
then,
asked you that.
And then the corporate level, I think, is also where a lot of people are trying to levy the power, because I think that they're hitting a wall with policy and policymakers. And so they say, let's just go directly to companies to see if they'll change their practices as a way to get, you know, more positive PR.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do think that's happening a lot. And I think there are lots of organizations who are out there, like As You Sow or Ceres, who are in the business of examining corporate policy as it relates to food, and then putting pressure on either the corporate structure itself or on shareholders to try to push them into doing things that are potentially beneficial to their bottom line at the end, like not ignoring climate change, for example.
Great.
Anyway, we should take a short break, unfortunately, and then we'll be right back with Twilight Greenaway, the managing editor of Civil Eats, for more about what we've talked about in the past couple of weeks here, and that is national food policy for the 21st century and the plate of the union. So stay tuned for more with Twilight.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
You recently, oh, sorry, this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm Katie Kiefer. I'm sorry. I'm like so excited about this discussion with Twilight Greenaway, my guest from Civil Eats. I wanted to get right into the next question, which is, because we don't have that much time, unfortunately, which is that you and your colleague Steve Holt recently wrote an article for Civil Eats about the plate of the union, which was something put out by the Union for Concerned Scientists. And Ricardo Salvador, who was a guest on this show a few weeks ago, talked about it. And you mentioned, you know, sort of the top five concerns that are addressed in the, or that for people who were asked questions about what they thought about something like the Plate of the Union or something like the white paper on national food policy for the 21st century. Tell us a little bit about the top five concerns and you know, why those were the ones that you, that really sprang out to you in a host of many, many issues.
Sure. So that article was specifically reporting on some polling that was done by Food Policy Action and the Union of Concerned Scientists and the HEAL Coalition, and they're all working together, as you said, on the Plate of the Union campaign. So what they did is they talked with Americans about food, and they talked with them for quite a while, and it was the kind of thing where folks who may not have come out and said, you know, I'm really concerned about food in America, when they actually started to talk about it, they identified several very specific things that they did turned out they wanted to see changed.
Right.
And the biggest one, and this doesn't surprise me at all, and I'm glad that they're highlighting it, is access to healthy food. The fact, as we were discussing earlier, that so many Americans can identify what's healthy and maybe even crave it, but they don't have the resources to buy it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So
either they don't have the resources.
That's the number one.
Yeah, or it's simply not available in their area, right?
Right.
Isn't that part
that's
of the
true.
Access issue?
Yes, absolutely. That's mm-hmm. a big part of the access issue. I mean, I think the fact that, whether you want to call them food deserts or not, but the fact that so many neighborhoods in America, you know, really lack a good grocery store or a good farmer's market or places to buy healthy food is a huge part of that equation, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, access was a big part of it. And then the growing rates of diabetes and other diet-related illnesses, in particular how they affect children, was a huge concern
yeah.
for most people, as well it should be. And then people were also very showed concern about the fact that so many workers in the food system are, as we started to discuss earlier, really getting kind of a raw deal. The people who are producing our food are in some of the worst jobs in America in terms of lack of decent pay and lack of benefits, and that is something that Americans, it turns out, think is a problem and would like to see politicians change.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the fact that so many of our farm subsidies are going to produce commodity crops and not necessarily helping farmers produce healthy fruits and vegetables and other healthy crops, that's another concern. And then
right.
they also ranked the environment and concern about the fact that farming often has a negative effect on the environment. They ranked that a little higher than they would have expected. I mean, it wasn't as big of a concern as food access, but it was on the list. It was something people did say they thought was a problem. So these are issues that really any lawmaker, but in particular the presidential candidates, could take up and probably get some traction out of.
Well, I mean, to that end, let us proceed immediately to one of my main questions of the day for you, my thought leading friend. What would you see as the main political planks if a Democratic, if any candidate, any presidential or even any legislative candidate were to incorporate a food into their campaign? What would be the top planks that you would like to see as part of that campaign? Did I make that? Is that clear? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, because, you know, I'm more in a journalism role, I won't say that I have my own personal agenda here, but I do think that if we look closely at what's happening, you know, even in the debate last night, that the fact that so many politicians are already talking about income inequality and that food is, in my mind, one of the most literal examples of income inequality.
Mm.
To me, that's a little bit of a no-brainer. I'm not sure why there isn't more work to weave those two issues together. Because, as you were saying, there is a certain percentage of the population who can afford to shop at Whole Foods and the farmers market, and then there is a very large percentage of the population that doesn't. So I do think that, in a way, it's not even its own issue, right? It's In that regard, food is just a very, I would say, a really blatant example of income inequality.
Most definitely.
So that strikes me as some of the low-hanging fruit. I think, you know, engaging people around farm policy, if you're working towards a primary in a farm state, is very challenging. So I understand why that hasn't come up. I think that particularly if you're Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, you're probably treading lightly in that area right now. But obviously those issues are important. When we talk about the way that our USDA dollars are spent, and as you pointed out, Pollan, Bittman, and Ricardo Salvador have all addressed this, there's kind of a disconnect between the amount of commodity crops, so wheat, corn, soybeans, cotton, rice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a disconnect between the amount of money that we're spending to make sure that those farmers can farm those crops at this very large scale, and then the fact that we're subsidizing, it's a different type of subsidized food, but we are providing SNAP benefits for consumers, and that most of those folks would like to be eating or would benefit from eating other kinds of food. So
besides corn and soy?
Yeah,
no kidding.
Besides the animal products that are created by the corn and soy, right? I mean, that's a huge piece of it.
Man does not live by meat alone, much as they would like to think that we do. I mean, I find that an incredible part of the whole program.
I mean, that's your cheap ground beef, right?
The
subsidized corn and soy.
You betcha. Absolutely.
If we didn't have that, it would be a very different equation.
Oh, most definitely. We are, you know, just killing ourselves to grow these crops. But we don't, it's not just for us. It's because we are selling them in enormous quantities to China, which cannot, mm-hmm. at the moment, fulfill their own feed requirements for their own livestock. And it's pretty much across the board. I mean, everybody's buying it. So, what else? What about something like I would like to see as a political plank, something that addresses the fact that companies like energy companies, and this goes really across the board of manufacturing as well as into the agricultural sector, but the fact that consumers pay the externalities, that mm-hmm. environmental impacts of so many industries are being absorbed by the consumer in terms of, or by the taxpayer, I should say. So, for instance, the Flint, Michigan scandal right now is a great example of that. But at the same time, we have a very similar situation that comes from agriculture as opposed to car factories. And that's what is happening in Des Moines right now, where the Des Moines Waterworks is suing the Up River counties because of the pollution coming downstream. And the same is true in Toledo, which lost a lot of their water quality issues from pollution in Lake Erie for the same reason Chesapeake Bay and on and on. That's a political plank that I would really love to see, is somehow mandate that those companies are paying the true costs of doing business. That would be my favorite one. I mean, I did talk to somebody, Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, about, he has introduced legislation about a carbon fee, not a tax and trade, but a carbon fee that would allow states to clean up their stuff that would come directly from those organizations. But anyway, before we move on from that topic, what else do you see as a political plank that would be like a feasible, something that Americans could understand and that, you know, candidates could get behind? What else do you see as something that would have an impact on an election cycle? If it's not this one, then the next one.
I mean, this is all very tricky, and I think there's a reason why we're not seeing it happening. but I do think...
Yeah, let's pie in the sky. Pie in the sky. Just make it up. Whatever you think.
I do think that you know, the connection between food and health is the other really big one.
Ah,
I mean, we've talked a little bit about it, but
you.
The fact that there's so much discussion around insurance and Obamacare and what happened with that or what hasn't happened with that, and I think Obama spoke a lot more about food in many ways before he was elected than he has since taking office. And I think Michelle Obama has done some really great work, but I do think that there could be a lot more done to tie diet-related illness and the enormous cost of diet-related illness.
Yeah, so relate so public health.
As taxpayers and then as individuals, I think there can be a lot more to tie that to healthcare and our larger discussion about healthcare.
I agree. I think that's a great plank. Twilight, I think that's like the plank, actually. That could be one of the major, I mean, really, if you think about it, if you tie public health to agricultural subsidies, then I guarantee you stuff would change. I mean, insurance companies would change their policy. I mean, it would really make a big difference. I remember Michael Pollan writing about that a few years ago, and I was like, wow, you know, like if insurance companies really paid more attention to how the impact of food policy on public health, I think there would be a lot of pushback from the insurance company in terms of all of those subsidies, et cetera. They would be saying like, well, why aren't we getting that? You know, like.
Sure. And I mean, I think if you look at Europe where governments care a lot more about keeping people healthy because they are footing the bill.
Yeah.
You see a very different scenario, right?
Yes.
So if, it wasn't quite as privatized as it is, we could see a different equation as well.
Yeah, very interesting. And then since we only have a few minutes left, I want to just ask you, why do you think the mainstream media largely ignores these topics? What do you think that is?
Yeah, I think,
as
I think
a journalist,
we differ on that.
What do you think?
I think that there are quite a few efforts to really go deeper on food in the mainstream media recently. I've been very impressed that, you know, we, Civil Eats, started out covering a lot of these issues in a little bit of a vacuum, and now we're really competing with the mainstream media on a lot of the same stories. I think NPR has done a really good job. I think the fact that MSNBC is has been working with Tom Colicchio, and the fact that Sam Kass is working with NBC to develop more food and food policy-related content, I think this is all, it's all really promising.
I agree.
So,
that
I
is
mean,
promising.
I think that policy in general is tricky stuff from a media perspective because it's eye-glazing for a lot of readers. So there's that. You know, it's never going to be super sexy. But I also think that there are a number of media sources, big and small, finding ways to tell these really interesting stories that can kind of bring the food on people's plate alive. And I'm really inspired daily by the pitches I get from writers, you know, people who may not have policy backgrounds and may not be, many of them are coming from the mainstream media. They may not be engaged in the food movement, but they are increasingly, you know, just curious about this stuff and wanting to get down to some of the nitty gritty.
Well, that's very encouraging. I love to end a show on a positive note like that, Twilight. Thank you very much.
Good.
And I have to agree with you. Like, I hadn't really been thinking about Tom Colicchio because, I mean, after all, what's happened? Like, nothing has happened yet. You know, the Food Policy Action, he doesn't have his own show for Food Policy Action. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'd like him to see. I'd like to see him get that. I'd like to see Olivier Deschuter and you know, Ricardo Zalvador and Dom Colicchio and Michael Pollan and all these guys, you know, get their day in the sun in terms of, like, not being, you know, vilified as sort of elitist. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, if you look at Michael Pollan, that's an interesting example, right? Because we just had the big PBS documentary about his book, In Defense of Food, or based on his book, In Defense of Food. It really
that's
goes
right.
to a lot of places, I think, sort of taking off from his book. But that ran on PBS, right? And then we have one coming out, a series coming out based
that's
on
right.
Cooked, and that's going to be on Netflix. So that is quite a bit, or at least potentially, quite a bit more mainstream.
Wow. Yeah, it sure is. Well, I love that story. See, what a great little interview this has been. You see, you just made my day with those two statements that, you know,
well,
look at what's happening.
We have to take the good news where we can get it, right?
Absolutely. And we can't just be, you know, backpedaling on, well, anyway, we can't just be being naysayers about all of this. I'm just impatient because I've been watching this stuff for quite a while and it's just...
Sure.
You know, move along, people get smart, you know, figure it out and start getting politicians involved.
To the USDA, one thing I wanted to say about the USDA that is also positive, I know we don't have very much more time, but
That's
I had a great conversation with Joe Leonard, who's their civil rights secretary within the USDA. And,
really?
You know, he's really doing a lot of interesting work. We're going to run an interview with him in the next week or two, and he and his office are doing a lot of interesting work to kind of slowly turn this very large ship, you know, not around entirely,
right.
but to turn it towards inclusion for people of color. Mm-hmm. And they are working on a county level to get more involvement with farmers of color. They're working to give microloans. They're, you know, it's stuff that's easy to overlook. None of it is very sexy.
Right.
But I was very inspired hearing from him about the ways that they're really trying to change the relationship between the USDA and farmers of color.
Wow.
So that's another positive one. And, you know, it's a really large agency,
yes.
a lot of employees, a lot of bureaucracy, and so there's you kind of have to take it slow and measured. But there are people in the USDA and outside of it working towards change on this gradual level that, you know, it's not always visible, but it's happening.
Well, on that note, we will conclude, and thank you very much. And I'm going to call that guy up myself and invite him onto the show. Thanks for the steer,
you're
honey.
An interesting guy.
And so for people who want to learn more about Twilight and Civil Eats, civileats.com and twilightgreenaway.com. Is that right, darling? Are you Twilight?
But Civil Eats is really
Civil Eats
sort
is
of
your...
where most of my work is appearing.
Yeah, exactly.
Civileats.com,
exactly.
And you can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. We have a great social media stream where we're sharing a lot of the food news, mainstream news, as well as the smaller scale stuff. So please hook in and sign up for our newsletter, and you'll learn a lot more really fast.
That's right. Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you to my sponsor, the International Culinary Center. And thanks to my engineer, Liz. And I'll see you next week or so. And I'll be reporting back about the International Processing and Packing Exposition in Atlanta that I'm going to next week. I can hardly wait. So thanks a lot for tuning in today, folks. And we'll see you next week. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.